question. This is the only question that the mainstream cares about, pretty much. We're not scientists. We're not that concerned about how things work. The only question anyone really wants to know is this question. And it's three questions. Anyone can answer it or answer the part that you want to answer. And I'm sorry to give you such an intense question, but this is the question. How do we prevent Alzheimer's? What contributes to it and what prevents it? How do we prevent heart disease? What contributes to it and what prevents it? How do we prevent cancer? What contributes to it and what prevents it? Anyone can answer any part of it.
Well, I guess I'll speak up again. It's rotating around to me, reverse alphabetical order almost. I would just defer to the wonderfully expert people we have on everything else, but I am one of the co-authors of, as Dr. Khan was mentioning, our guidelines, American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, for primary prevention of heart disease. And we basically focus on, you know, the seven issues. Are you smoking? Are you doing a good job of following your blood pressure? Know what your cholesterol is, blood sugar, and managing it, trying to get rid of it. Exercising enough. We focused, believe it or not, on aspirin. Put that in primary prevention because it's something that doesn't belong, that we had wrong for about 40 years. And unless your person is at high risk. So if you're interested in that one, just can look up hashtag rethink aspirin. We should be using a bit less for primary prevention. And then the cornerstone of it is nutrition. And if we are true to the literature, we're going to avoid the saturated fat, the avoid cholesterol. We're avoiding sugar-sweetened beverages. Trans fats, fortunately, are illegal publicly in the United States and three other countries in the world, which is great. But if we are going to lower the sodium in the diet, we do these things, and the heart disease that has developed and is so ubiquitous in the United States, leading killer of Americans since, really since 1918, when the other pandemic took it out for a year. COVID, we thought it was going to take it out. The CDC says it didn't quite make it. And so heart disease was still number one in 2020. We've got a major issue of this dual pandemic, and it's time to address it. So I would say the prevention of coronary disease, heart failure, we have all the principles, and they're all in that document, but it's hard to summarize that in 2 minutes or less. But those are the major principles, and we could go a very far way of improving our healthcare finances, which is critical, particularly after COVID, when Medicare is going to go broke, and now in 2024 instead of 2026. So I'm telling everybody, it's your patriotic duty to do the lifestyle things that we have outlined and decrease our healthcare costs.
I'm just going to piggyback for two vegan cardiologists, just a couple of thoughts on heart disease, and we'll leave cancer and brain disease to the two experts. I mean, one, get a home blood pressure cuff. I think, you know, statistically, blood pressure is the biggest killer in the world, a global burden of disease study. And yet we have the worst mechanism of monitoring your blood pressure. You have to have a cuff, you have to use it, you have to relax, you have to do it three times. We need technology to deal with it. But at the meantime, go to the drugstore, buy a $39 blood pressure cuff. We make a big dent on Health of America. Number two, you know, you can for free in Cleveland and for $50 in Chicago and Detroit, get a heart calcium CT scan if you got some risk factors. If you knew you had heart disease, would you be motivated to follow the lifestyle that Dr. Williams has been writing about? So coronary artery calcium CT scanning for most, according to American Heart and new National Lipid Association guidelines, is taking a higher precedence. Something has been available for 30 years. But, you know, we do colonoscopy, we do mammography, we do cancer skin checks. We don't do heart disease checks. We have the technology without injecting dye. The dye study is a much better study, but it's not really a screening study. And I think probably Dr. Williams would agree. And then finally, I'm a big fan. We have this thing called residual risk. You are actually doing the simple seven of the American Heart Association, yet you have a heart attack. You probably should know your lipoprotein A, which is a particle in the blood, at $20. You can measure, or your apolipoprotein B, $20, you can measure. A little technical, but we still got this group of people that on paper look pretty good and have events, and without a lot of expense, which is critical, as Dr. Williams just mentioned. we can just, you know, up the game a little bit. They aren't yet in guidelines, but they have, you know, thousands of peer-reviewed papers. So I go a little broader in my testing, always cognizant of patient costs, but, you know, there's this lifestyle cost, or, you know, quality of life cost and burden of life cost and death cost. So Bob Harper, the famous fitness guru of The Biggest Loser show, brought a lot of attention to this genetic particle called lipoprotein A. And I know it's in European guidelines, it's not in American guidelines, but anyways, we have to always look for what's the next science-based addition to the armamentarium. But we're doing terrible at measuring blood pressure, so, you know, we probably should do that first. Okay, good.
Steve, is it okay if we stay on heart disease just for a moment? Not a rebuttal.
It is still 2020. Who died most? Heart disease, cancer. Exactly. Number three was COVID, but it's still number one. Yeah.
So just to respond, really, to Dr. Khan, we did update the guidelines. And so now you have your new lipids guidelines, the prevention guidelines from 2019 and 2020. They're all saying that we do use Lp(a), and we do use ApoB, and we do use coronary calcium scoring along with other measures of enhanced risk. So everybody should have the ASCVD risk calculator. You can get it online, you can put it on your phone. And if you're in that intermediate risk zone, do you really go on a statin? Do you really change your lifestyle? Hopefully you do the latter no matter what, but we actually use, there are 14 of them. They're looking at ankle brachial indices, as well as the tests that Dr. Khan just mentioned. Those are our risk modifiers that if they are positive, then it pushes you toward more aggressive therapy. So they did finally make it into the guidelines. They are, you know, in a narrow window for the people who, where it's not obvious, they haven't had a heart attack, they don't have extremely low risk. They're sort of in that intermediate zone. So we are employing them. And, yeah. And please, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just want to tell you, in terms of access and equality and economics, you had a run in Detroit. I actually volunteered a free women's clinic in Highland Park, Michigan, one of the most indigent, low-income areas. And Mitch Albom funds it. God bless Mitch Albom. And, you know, I'm talking to a 62-year-old diabetic woman who's about 200 pounds. I mean, a nuclear stress test at $1,400 is not in her ability, but a $50 calcium CT scan at Harbor Hospital, Sonny Grace, is within her ability. So some of these technologies are definitive, and they include, not exclude, people that aren't traditionally getting really optimal medical care, which is really cool. Win-win everywhere.
So the two last points I was going to make is, one is coronary calcium is critical. It's important to make sure that it's available. Unfortunately, in Chicago, we did a recent analysis and we submitted to publication. We're presenting it, I guess, in a couple of weeks at the American College of Cardiology, saying that if you're in a poorer neighborhood, the hospital near you does not have this available. And it's really something that we have to address. And one of the ways to address it, like you mentioned, Cleveland, they have it for free. In Texas, insurance pays for it. And so we've got to do something so that the people who are at risk and don't know that they have this, it's a test that has been shown to change physician behavior and patient behavior. And so getting this test out there in the public where it's available is really important. The last thing I want to highlight, double down on what you said about blood pressure and blood pressure measurement. Our 2017 guidelines, sure, we talk about office hypertension. Everybody knows about white coat office hypertension. What they don't understand is that in our inner cities, we have some people who are living alone, elderly 85-year-old woman by herself in one of the neighborhoods that I grew up in, like Inglewood or Gresham in Chicago. There's gunfire. She's afraid. You put her in an office and I'm 45 minutes behind and she's comfortable, relaxed, nice environment, everyone being nice to her. Her blood pressure can be 30 millimeters lower in my office than it is at home. Wow. So that's in the 2017 guidelines. It's called masked uncontrolled hypertension. It may not be as frequent as office hypertension, but both of them are good reasons to do exactly what Dr. Khan is saying. Do those blood pressures at home where they're actually meaningful.
Maybe I should chime in here. Thank you for my esteemed colleagues. I have a very different viewpoint than you two just expressed, even though I respect what you're doing on a societal basis, but I kind of don't agree with the emphasis. Right now, we have 89% of our population is with this BMI above 25. We have fat on the body promotes both cancer and heart disease. We have an explosion of pre-diabetes. We have more than 60% of our elderly population with high blood pressure. I don't see the answer is what you guys are saying. We know that everybody that eats the American diet is going to develop heart disease, high blood pressure, be pre-diabetic, move towards increased risk of cancer. I mean, you can't achieve good health by checking blood pressures and medicating people. In fact, that is the problem. The problem is what the cardiologists and what the conventional cardiologists and other doctors have developed treatments for risk factors. They give you a drug to lower cholesterol, a drug to lower blood pressure, a drug to control your blood glucose. They think controlling these measurable risk factors is the way to control the risk of the population. And I'm saying it's really the emphasis is on the wrong syllable here. The point I'm making right now is your BMI, if you're a woman, is your BMI below 21? If you're a male, is a BMI below 20? Below 22? Do you eat a diet of at least 95% whole plant foods? Do you put salt on your food? Do you exercise? In other words, is your lunch a large salad with a bowl of vegetable bean soup and a piece of fruit? I mean, what are we talking about measuring people's risk factors when they're eating themselves to death? And every person that eats that diet is going to develop abnormal risk factors and be fodder for the doctors to give them more medications and more medications. All I'm saying right now is these diseases that kill everybody and affect our whole population are not the inevitable consequence of aging. They're predominantly genetic. We're not measuring people's risks. Nobody, almost nobody would have these risks. Less than 1 in 1,000 people would genetically be need to measure lipoprotein A or allele 4 and things that would affect their ability to take extra drugs or extra something different. 999 out of 1,000 people, all they need to do is change their lifestyle, get rid of all their body fat. Males should have a body fat probably below 12.5%, and females probably below 23, 24%. I mean, in other words, let's focus on the issue here. Now, it's okay to be different, but I'm saying right now, I'm less concerned with all these testing. My starting point when a person comes to me is to begin by achieving their ideal weight. Whatever I'm measuring, blood pressure, cholesterol, sure, I'm going to wean them gradually off the medication. But those issues always resolve as they eat healthfully and lose weight. I'm interested in measuring more and getting more data on them. I'm interested in making sure they're dropping at least 3 pounds a week. If they're not dropping at least a kilogram a week, they're not doing the right thing. We're talking about a complete overweight population that has to completely revisit the way they think about food. They can't eat anything close to the way other people's eat. And if they're not losing weight each week, don't forget insulin resistance is going to come down as people lose weight, but it improves just as they're dropping weight. And you drop more than a kilogram a week, you see improvements in insulin resistance. You see dropping your at more than a kilogram a week, you see angiogenesis start to go down and aromatase stimulation, high estrogen start to come down before the people lose all their whole weight. What I'm saying right now, the inflammatory markers, the high myeloperoxidase or oxidized LDL or hsCRP, these inflammatory markers start to go down, which really document a person's high risk of the cardiac event. Start to decrease within a few weeks and even normalize while the person is overweight as long as they're dropping 2 or 3 pounds a week. Certainly if they're not going to lose that fast as they start to get closer to their ideal weight. But I'm much less focused on what's being discussed here, which I'm not against that for the general population. But our whole general population is eating a deadly diet that whether they have those risk factors or not are still going to likely have heart disease and cancer even without those risk factor measurements. And if they don't have a high risk of heart disease, eating that way, they're going to develop a high risk of cancer and dementia anyway. So what's the point of focusing on one disease when they first have to focus on getting their health and their diet fixed and their weight fixed? And if you don't have that, you don't have anything, because there's no such thing as a healthy overweight person. Even if you medicated their glucose favorable, you got their blood pressure well controlled, you medicated their cholesterol down, and they're still overweight, they're still sickly, they're still at high risk of premature death, and they're still going to develop diseases. And the doctor is focusing on things they can treat instead of seeing, let's radically change the way people think about healthcare, think about their diet, and think about their own personal health. Because if they don't first start at an idea, wait, what are we measuring? If you have a lot of body fat on your body, you have a lot of saturated fat on your body, and that saturated fat is still going to fuel oxidized LDL and cholesterol production. First, get thin. First, get rid of your body fat. First, get lean, get muscular, and get lean with plants. And make sure you're well-nourished with all the nutrients people need. And then let's see if there's any residual risk. I've cared for thousands of people this way with advanced heart disease. Even people with low ejection fractions have their ejection, you know, over the, would build collateral circulation back and have the hibernating myocardium come back. And even my own father-in-law had a heart failure with a low ejection fraction. Now, 15 years later, his ejection fraction is normal. But I have so many people who've reversed calcified heart, reverse calcified valves, reverse congestive heart failure, got back ejection fraction, normalized kidney function. And so I'm saying is that radical nutrition is the starting place. The starting place is radical nutrition, not measuring people and doing more tests on them. Anyway, that's my two cents. Sorry to be so, passionately different.
So you're actually not, Dr. Furman. I hope everyone is listening to what you said. Every ACC, I can proudly say, every ACC guideline since about 2017, including our hypertension one, has made exactly the points that you just made. That is, we start with lifestyle. We don't just pull out the statin at 7.5% 10-year risk. We do lifestyle first. We try to get the weight down. We try to get all of the risk factors down. And that means nutrition and exercise. I remember the trauma of publishing that document and having people say that we dropped the definition of hypertension from 140 to 130 so we could be in the pocket of industry. That just meant they didn't read the document. The document gave a list of non-pharmacologic therapies. And number one, just like you said, is losing weight. And we talked about cutting the alcohol, exercising with three different modalities, lower the sodium, increase the potassium, and do as much plants as you can on the diet. So every one of our documents makes exactly that point. And the 2019 prevention guideline I was talking about, the obesity section is actually the largest. That's the one with the most words in it, the most recommendations. And I'm hoping everybody takes exactly what you just said very seriously.
Thank you so much.
So I agree with very much of what Dr. Furman said. And I think the point with respect to cognitive decline is that the arsenal, which we have been told is zero, that there's nothing you can do, and this has been printed by the Alzheimer's Association for years, there's nothing you can do to prevent, reverse, or delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, the opposite is the truth. There is a huge arsenal, and it starts with some of the things we've heard about: diet, exercise, sleep, stress, in this case, brain training, detoxification, and supplementation where appropriate. And so we've been interested, as I mentioned earlier, in the mechanisms. What are the molecules that actually drive this? Because it's been an area where there simply hasn't been success. Over 150,000 papers have been published over the years on Alzheimer's disease without a successful approach to it previously. So if you actually look at what's driving this, what we find again and again is it is anything that's producing inflammation. And there are all sorts of things from P. gingivalis from the oral microbiome to HSV from the lip to mold species that are in the sinuses. Pathologists find all of these in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's. So what we call Alzheimer's disease is actually a protective response to these various insults. And so you can look at inflammatory type Alzheimer's, which is what we call type 1. There is an atrophic type, which is reduction of support from trophic factors, hormones, or nutrients. There is a glycotoxic. People have talked about type 3 diabetes, and certainly insulin resistance is incredibly common, and it is an important contributor to Alzheimer's disease. And then there's what we call type 3, which is toxic. Whether you're exposed to metallotoxins or other inorganics, as a simple example, the people that were the first responders in the World Trade Center, by 2015, 13% of them already had cognitive decline. So any way that you're getting exposed, and here in California, the California fires are going to increase the likelihood. And of course, we're hearing a lot about COVID-19 and long haulers syndrome and brain fog and things like this. So we'll see over years, but it's likely that there will be an increased risk for cognitive decline there as well. Or whether you're talking about organic toxins, things like benzene and toluene and formaldehyde and glyphosate, or you're talking about biotoxins, things like trichothecenes. And as a classically trained neurologist and neuroscientist, I was surprised when it turned out that people were getting cognitive decline associated with these things that I had never been taught were related to cognitive decline. And then, of course, vascular disease, one of the most common contributors to cognitive decline. And finally, head trauma. So those are the six subtypes, and those are the things that are the major contributors. Now, what you can do about it, absolutely. I think the term radical nutrition that Joel just used, I think is a fabulous term. And we've followed his work for years, my wife and myself. So this is absolutely crucial. So many people have, if you look at what's actually happening in the brain of a patient with Alzheimer's, the misunderstanding about Alzheimer's has been that everybody wants it to be something simple. They say, oh, it's reactive oxygen species, it's misfolded proteins, it's a prion, it's on and on and on. And there are dozens and dozens of theories. At the heart of it, if you look at the molecular biology of this degenerative process, at the heart of this, it is an insufficiency. It's just that it's not a simple insufficiency like vitamin C. It is an insufficiency of the support of a neuroplasticity network that is critical for learning and memory. And so you have a whole set of things that you have to supply, and you have a whole set of things that represent demand. And everybody with Alzheimer's disease has more demand than supply. And therefore, you do need to change your diet. You do need to create insulin sensitivity. You do need to reduce inflammation. And there are excellent ways to do this. We heard earlier about a colonoscopy. Absolutely. We recommend that anyone who's 45 years of age or older get a cognoscopy. And that's relatively straightforward to do. There are some simple blood tests that will measure the very things I was just talking about. Measure things like your hsCRP and your HOMA-IR and your various mycotoxins and various organic toxins. These things are relatively straightforward to do, and then you can address those things. As a general rule, yes, absolutely. Diet, exercise, sleep, stress, brain training, appropriate supplementation and detox. That's the way to go, those seven things. But you can be much more specific if you actually look at where you stand with each of these, because this is the problem, of course, with chronic illness. By the time you get symptoms from chronic illnesses, you are most of the way through the pathophysiology. And that's been shown very nicely with longitudinal studies, PET scan studies, and cerebrospinal fluid studies to show that you get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's about 20 years after the pathophysiology can be shown to start. And that's just the stuff we can see. It's likely there's some micropathology going on. So this disease that we used to think of as a disease of our 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, is really a disease of our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s that happens to get diagnosed 20 years later. So in fact, you know, the same thing we're seeing with standard American diet and all these things is a major issue. Now, I see there are a couple of comments about why we recommend what we recommend, and we can go into details. I know there's not enough time here at the moment, but we go to details about everything that we do. Part of what is critical in this insufficiency that we call Alzheimer's disease is that if you do a PET scan, you can see that there is decreased glucose utilization for at least 10 years before. In fact, people who have the most common risk factor, APOE4, and let's talk about that for just a second, there are about 75 million Americans who have single copy APOE4. If you have zero copies, which is 3/4 of the population, your lifetime risk for Alzheimer's is about 9%. If you have a single copy, it's about 30%. If you have two copies, it's well over 50%. It's more likely that you will develop Alzheimer's. And that's 7 million Americans. So we firmly believe that Alzheimer's should be and can be today a rare disease, instead of what Professor Yaffe showed a few years ago, that it was the third leading cause of death. Now, of course, COVID's knocked that out. So it may be the fourth leading cause of death right now, but it is a very, very common cause of death, costing the United States over $300 billion a year in healthcare. And as has been pointed out by Maria Shriver, 65% of Alzheimer's patients are women, 60% of caregivers are women. So in fact, this should be a rare disease. Now, the diet we have proposed is simply, again, because we've looked at over 5,000 people now who are on the protocol we developed. And those who you can basically get there dietarily from two ways. You have got to address this gap in metabolism. That's the problem. And Dr. Stephen Kinane showed years ago, you can do this with ketones. So you actually see a decrease in glucose utilization in the temporal lobe and parietal lobe for virtually everybody with Alzheimer's disease. And yes, you can get at that with endogenous ketosis. Great way to do it. You can be a vegetarian if you like. You can have some fish or some pastured, you know, wild caught fish, especially smashed fish, some pastured chicken and some grass-fed beef if you want to do that. Small amounts, no problem. And again, you want to be a vegetarian, no problem. The point is to direct the underlying biochemistry that we now understand much better than we did just a few years ago that is actually required for meeting those synaptogenic demands. So you have, just as we know that osteoporosis is about osteoblastic signaling versus osteoclastic signaling, what we found in the laboratory is no different, that Alzheimer's disease is about synaptoblastic signaling being chronically exceeded by synaptoclastic signaling. So there are four basic parameters that derive this. One of them is anything that produces inflammation. You can follow the molecular pathways from NF-kappa-B activation, inflammation, to activation of two proteases that give you the amyloid that collects in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease. So it's about inflammation, it's about toxicity, then it's about reduced energetics, and that is blood flow, oxygenation, ketosis, and mitochondrial function. And it's about trophic activity, estradiol, testosterone, vitamin D, all the things that are supportive. So the bottom line is, this should be a rare disease. And doing the very things that you've heard from Dr. Furman and Dr. Kahn and Dr. Williams will have tremendous impact on reducing the global burden of dementia. And that's our goal.
Dr. Bredesen, I know you're going to be leaving this panel early. Can you sum up everything you just said into a simple 1-minute version of what are the most specific action steps we should take to do, and what are the most specific action steps that we shouldn't do? I know that's just what you answered, but now Can you give us a super cliff note answer of specifically what are you saying are the actions we should take to do, and what should we avoid, as simple and direct for the general not scientific public?
Yeah, apologies that I have to leave for another meeting in a few minutes, but thank you again for the invitation. It's fantastic to be on with some of my heroes here. So the bottom line here is to recognize that this is the problem with Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, you can now evaluate what your risk is, just as you would get an advanced lipid profile. You can now get a profile to see where you stand with respect to cognitive decline. The brain is complicated, so you've got to know what your status with these various hormones and trophic factors and things are. But I would recommend that everybody who's 45 years of age or older, please get a cognoscopy and look to see where you stand. It's pretty easy, blood testing. As far as blood testing, I should say, and if you have symptoms, MRI, and some simple online cognitive assessment, it's pretty easy to do. Now, Cliff Notes version of what to do would be, a mildly ketogenic, plant-rich, high-fiber diet. I would say not terribly different than what we've all learned from Dr. Furman over the years, with appropriate fasting. And there's no question that again and again and again, we see that the people who do the best are getting themselves to be insulin sensitive, to be non-inflammatory, and to be in mild ketosis. And by that, I mean 1 to 4 millimolar beta-hydroxybutyrate. If you want to check it by breathalyzer, you want to be acetone levels, 7 to 10 or higher. So these are that's the beginning. And then exercise is critical, again, for a number of reasons. Each of these things has multiple impacts. And then getting appropriate sleep. And many people have reduced oxygenation when they are sleeping and don't know it. Their doctors don't check it. It's absolutely crucial and a very common contributor to cognitive decline. And then stress levels. Stress is a huge issue. And in fact, just bumping up your cortisol is associated with a shrunken brain. So it is absolutely a critical contributor. And then, as I mentioned, doing some brain training, some stimulation is quite helpful. And then detoxification. Again, most of us have toxin levels we're not aware of. So getting detox and even just starting with some basics like filtered water and high fiber diets and lots of crucifers and all these sorts of things, very, very helpful. And then appropriate supplementation. And again, this depends a little on where you stand, but those are the major ones. And so, Stephen, have I answered your question?
Yes.
Thank you.
Joel, Con, I just want to just shout in because there, you know, there is more agreement and there's no disagreement actually, but the very inexpensive or free test I mentioned, coronary artery calcium scoring, if you drop dead of a heart attack at 52, you don't have to worry about Alzheimer's dementia, which is really numerically make sure you know your heart status and we can worry about your brain status at 50, 60, 70. But if you have a coronary artery calcium score of zero, 11 studies, including one just published about 2 months ago from the Netherlands, if you have a coronary artery calcium score of zero, you have a very healthy brain. If you have a coronary artery calcium score in the 99th percentile, you have a very unhealthy brain because oxidative stress, inflammation, nutrition, sleep, stress, environmental toxins, social factors all integrate in a very simple way that we can measure. It's not perfect, but it's close to perfect and quite inexpensive. So, you know, there's unity in what we're saying. And all the therapies we talk about, radical nutrition addresses all the organ systems that we're dealing with.
Thanks, Joel. Maybe I can contribute a little bit here. Have my own way of seeing things. Just to bring things back down to specifics and specific recommendations and do's and don'ts is to review again that if you eat a conventional diet, you're destined, if you live long enough, to get demented, have memory loss, and develop some form of neurologic deficit with aging. If you don't, cancer or heart disease doesn't get you first. And I want to make it clear that we're saying that the diet that maximally slows aging and prevents cancer is also most effective to prevent heart disease and dementia. There's not one specific program for dementia that's different than the one that prevents heart disease and cancer. The anti-cancer diet, which lowers inflammation and improves immune function, is most effective to be dementia protective. So let me just say this clear, that white flour products and sugars and sweeteners, including honey and maple syrup, including bread and bagels and cookies and Fruit Loops and cold cereals and donuts and crackers and rice cakes and breakfast bars and chips, that all these foods are of high glycemic carbohydrates, people live on more than half of the American diet is high glycemic processed carbohydrates that are linked to dementia and stroke and cancer. So being specific that you can't eat the way other Americans eat. And then Americans eat a ton of fried foods where you create more reactive oxygen species and inflammation. Sure, inflammation and toxins lead to cancer and dementia, but we have to stop eating things that cause us to be toxic. And particularly, we're talking about a diet rich in animal products also contributes to the toxic load, including microplastic, including glyphosate, including cadmium, including toxic metals. We're talking about a diet that's as animal products go up in the diet invariably, so does toxic waste at the same time. We dump 1,000 tons of garbage into the oceans every hour. But the point I'm making right now is that we're looking at diets that maximally slow human lifespan and prevent all causes of death and disability. And we know that diets that promote ketosis may have some temporary benefits for certain conditions, but overall as a whole, ketosis-bearing diets lead to shorter lifespans and a higher cardiovascular deaths and a higher cancer deaths. Because when you restrict carbohydrates to get into ketosis, you usually have to include more animal fats and animal products to a point which has a more negative effect than any benefit moderate ketosis will give you. So I'm not encouraging, I'm saying there's no need to try to promote ketosis if your diet is already glycemically favorable, where your plant foods are whole plants, predominantly low glycemic carbohydrates, like beans and quinoa and nuts and vegetables and eggplant and mushrooms. And when you're eating, you know, the right type of plants, your diet is already glycemically favorable. It's true, some vegan or plant-based people are trying to restrict certain foods like nuts and making the diet too carbohydrate and too glycemically favorable. And you guys know a lot of plant-based vegans are eating a lot of white flour, white rice, white potato, eating a lot of high glycemic carbohydrates and do not have a glycemically or nutritionally favorable diet. But that doesn't mean telling people to go into ketosis is the right answer. And if so, because we want to keep the diet, of course, as plant-based as possible, mostly vegan and animal products should be used as condiments or special occasion foods at the most because they're linked with other problems with later life, including promoting excessive cancer growth and because of the contribute to the toxic load the body has to bear with. Just wanted to add those couple of things.
If I could just respond quickly here with respect to ketosis. So again, we're agnostic, whatever is going to help these people. As I mentioned earlier, the problem is that when they come in and it may be that, Joel, what you're saying is the best way for prevention. Great. But once the person is already having symptoms, the PET scan shows you have an energetic failure. You have to bridge that energetic gap. And yes, it's possible that you over the long haul could do this, but we consider this an emergency. When someone comes in, they're not able to metabolize enough glucose to keep their synapses going. Then time after time after time, there's just no question, getting some degree of ketosis helps their cognition. Now, perhaps the way to do it is to do it with exogenous ketones. Again, we're agnostic, whatever's going to help these people. But you know, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense for the prevention people. When we see someone with cognitive decline, either we're going to be successful or they're going to die. This is a terminal illness. And up until recently, it's 100% terminal. So far, what we found works best is to get them into some degree of ketosis. Now, maybe the way to go is to slowly get them off that over 6 months or a year after they've improved their cognition. Again, we're just looking at data. What actually helps this? So I'd love to talk to you further about how we might do this better and still get the right support for them. We're going by Dr. Kinane's work showing that you can bridge that gap with sufficient ketosis.
It's NAD for these people who start cognitive decline?
Certainly NAD is helpful. I mean, and I should say, we're not recommending meat. We're talking about a plant-rich ketogenic diet. So, you know, monounsaturates, polyunsaturates, that sort of thing. We're saying if you want to have some meat, fish, chicken, do it the appropriate way, do it in small amounts. But at the end of the day, this is a plant-rich ketogenic diet with appropriate fasting. That's what's worked best so far. And again, we're open. If anything is going to make these people still better, we're open to that.
No, I understand. And I use that, you know, the fasting obviously too, but.
Well, Neil Barnard just did a randomized study of the whole food, plant-based, naturally low-fat diet versus the Mediterranean diet. And there was, you know, about 400 calorie difference. People had satiety on a whole food, plant-based diet. They didn't measure ketones by breath or blood or any other method. But when you're eating 1,700 versus 2,100 calories a day, you may well be in a more favorable ketotic or minimally ketotic state. That's a hypothesis because it wasn't measured. But it certainly was an interesting observation that people weren't hungry all day long, loading up on broccoli and Brussels sprouts and brown rice. It was quite the opposite. They were quite sated. I don't think.
And that's the paradox. I mean, and that's the paradox. These people are in an energy deficient state. We need to support them, whether it's with ketosis, whatever. We need to make them more insulin sensitive. And at the same time, you're right. We want to get them in a lower calorie diet. So that's the paradox.